Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
This is episode 74. I'm your host, Dan Prosser, joined as ever by Andrew Frankel. Hello, Andrew. Little wave there. Now, this is another one of our podcasts about people. We introduced this format a couple of weeks ago with Sir Jackie Stewart. And this time it's about another Formula One world champion, Michael Schumacher. Now, not all of these are going to be about Formula One world champions. In fact, we're going to make sure that they're not, because we want to talk about other people. We want to talk about designers and engineers and company executives, all sorts. But this just feels like the right time to dedicate an episode of the podcast to Michael Schumacher, doesn't it? Do you want to explain why?
A couple of reasons. Firstly, it's 30 years since he burst onto the Grand Prix scene in 1991. And secondly, because on September the 15th, I think, there's going to be what I believe is the first Schumacher documentary. It's going out on Netflix September the 15th, and it's going to be really, really interesting to see. I'm really interested to see this is a documentary that is, so far as I can see, it's basically been done by his family, or certainly with the total cooperation of his family. I would say almost certainly in association with his family. So it'll be very much the view of the man that they want to present. We are told, if you read the comments coming from the director, she says it's going to be warts and all. It's going to be the ups and downs, because Corinna, Michael's wife, doesn't want to just do a sort of sugar-coated, totally positive story. I think apparently she wants to tell it as it is. So who knows? We'll see. But it's going to be really, really interesting. And he's like sort of Senna, isn't he? He's just one of the most, whether you're a fan or whether you're not a fan, I don't think that anybody could say that he was boring as a character, as a driver, in the same way you might, some people could say that, I don't know, Alain Prost could be boring in that way. I mean, Michael was always courting controversy. He was always doing amazing things. I think our sport is massively richer for having had him in it. And it's obviously desperately sad for the last, it's coming up 8 years now since he had the accident. Nobody really knows what his current situation is. But, I just think it's terribly sad that, he's obviously had this terrible, terrible time. Michael it is.
Yeah, so we're not going to speculate on his condition, mostly because any more than anybody else, nor will we even talk about the accident.
We're not that kind of journalist.
No, we're not. So by the time this episode of the podcast goes out, an article that you've written for the Intercooler app will have gone live. And it was, I suppose, like this podcast, inspired by this Netflix documentary that's on its way.
Yeah.
And in it, you sort of address your feelings about Michael Schumacher. And probably it will resonate with a lot of people, certainly did with me. Particularly during his career, he wasn't the easiest character to like, was he, necessarily?
No, he wasn't at all. I've gone up and down a bit with Lewis. There have been times when I haven't been a Lewis type fan, and there are times when I've been a huge Lewis fan. I'm a pretty big Lewis fan at the moment. I'm not quite as big a Lewis fan as I have been. I think last year I was like Lewis, super uber fanboy. This year, not. But with Michael, I was just all over the place. You know, when he was in the Benetton, you know, driving Damon off the road to deny him a world championship in 94. I mean, I just loathed the bloke. But then he went and joined Ferrari. And as I think I've spoken about this podcast before, you know, I can judge Ferrari road cars completely objectively. I can treat them like anything else. But, cut me and I bleed Scuderia Ferrari. I just do. The race team, I just want Ferraris to win. And I just don't understand. I've never really understood why that is. But, okay, we're recording this before Sunday, before Spa on Sunday. But whatever happens, or happened as you're listening to this last Sunday, I just want a Ferrari to win. It's awful, isn't it?
But
the point being is that when Michael joined Ferrari in 96, suddenly I kind of had to like him because he was driving from a team. And then he started doing ridiculous things in the first Ferraris that he drove, which are terrible cars. And I just suddenly thought, okay, so this guy really is really is that good. And it kind of, well, I'm sure we'll get into it, but it kind of sort of blossomed from there. And I'm now a huge fan. I'm a huge, huge fan. I'm not blind at all. I'm not blind at all to, you know, all the stuff that he did. And I think that he damaged his reputation. I think that there will always be, he's never going to be a golden boy of the sports, is he? He's never going to be a bloke who could do no wrong, because he did a lot of wrong. But also, you know, to an extent, isn't that? Now, I'm not excusing it at all, but, you know, Ayrton was the same. Actually, in many ways, I think particularly what Senna did to Prost at Suzuka, wasn't it? To win a world championship. I mean, I think that was even more Machiavellian than anything that Michael ever did. And, you know, to an extent, you can't forgive this. Well, you can forgive this stuff. You can't forget it, but you can try to understand it. And these people do become more human as a result.
I've sort of felt the same. We'll get into it a little bit later on, but yeah, I wasn't keen on the guy when he was active, but with a bit of time, with a bit of distance, you start recognizing everything that he achieved and you just think, wow. So let's just run through his Formula One career. 308 Grand Prix, a lot. 91 wins, 68 poles, and 7 titles. And most of those were records until Lewis Hamilton came along and Mercedes came along and just started nicking all of Schumacher's records. Let's go back a bit further and talk about...
Can I say one thing on that?
Okay. Go on.
And I'm not in any way denigrating Lewis at all, but I think I'm right in saying is that Lewis has never been in anything other than the first or second best car on the grid. Is that fair to say?
I think the 2009 McLaren was a bit of a shocker.
Okay, a season. You know, Michael, 1996, 1997, 1998, 3 seasons with Ferrari. Okay, 1999, the car was good. He didn't win the championship of the year, but the car was good. But he chose to go to Ferrari in 1996 when Ferrari was an absolute basket case. You know, it couldn't get out of its own way. You know, from 1991 to 1995, Ferrari was in, you know, basically the worst it had ever been. And so Michael decided to go there and go for a completely uncompetitive team. When he came back with Mercedes, you know, we forget that Mercedes was very much a kind of middle order team then. So, you know, Lewis has done amazing stuff and everything else, but you have to see it in the context of the equipment that they had. And if Michael had had the consistency of brilliant commitment of equipment through his career that Lewis has enjoyed, I don't think Lewis would be where Michael is, would even have got to where Michael would have got to had he had that.
Well, that is a big statement. You'd have to look through some data, wouldn't you, to really back that up? But I don't know.
He also took, what was it, 3 years out in the middle of his career?
Yeah, he did. What do I think about that?
He was out, wasn't he?
Yeah, so I think Lewis did join Mercedes when it was a proper mid-pack team, but then, of course, there was a feeling, wasn't there, that from 2014 that would be the team to be at, and so it transpired. Anyway, we can come back to this because I just want to talk about his pre-F1 days. I don't know how familiar you are with his very early career,
He just won everything, didn't he? He was karting. I think he was karting when he was four.
Okay, we're not going back quite that far. We're only going back to 1990 when he won the German F3 Championship, and that year he was
Willy
also
Weber.
Yeah. And that year he was also racing with Sauber Mercedes in the World Sports Car Championship, that was an interesting move, wasn't it? I mean, clearly this guy was on his way towards Formula One, but he was advised He was advised to go and do some endurance racing because it's a different type of car. It's working with teammates. He was part of the young driver squad, wasn't he? And he was just advised that everything that he would experience in that sort of environment would ultimately make him a better racing driver.
Yeah, and I think it was also about being, you know, out of the car. It was a much, you know, because most people obviously went from Formula 3 to Formula 3000 into Formula 1 that way. But I think Willy Weber identified that, you know, if you're going to become a fully rounded Formula 1 driver, you know, you need to have played on the bigger stages with really big team, proper works manufacturer team, you know, like Mercedes-Benz, and go and do races like Le Mans. It's a little known fact. It's another one of my weird Le Mans spotty stats. Fastest lap at Le Mans in 1991, M. Schumacher, Esquire. Nobody thinks about that. Nobody thinks about Michael as being a Le Mans driver as well, at all. But yeah, he was there. Fastest lap of the race.
Finished fifth.
Oh, there you go.
Decent result, isn't it? He won in 1990 and 1991. Him and his co-drivers, if you like, won a couple of races. It's really interesting to just speculate and ponder how much that helped his career, driving a very different type of car, different environment, different type of racing, working with teammates. Maybe we should see more of these younger guys doing that sort of thing.
Obviously, it established the Mercedes connection, didn't it?
Well, quite. Yeah, it did, which came back around a good couple of decades later. It was in 1990 as well that he won the Macau GP, which really is where future F1 world champions announced themselves, isn't it? Or it was back
didn't
in the day.
Didn't something...
It did.
That was like the first sign of it that he would kind of do above and beyond to get what he wanted.
Yeah, controversial circumstances. Can you remember who he is racing? A sign of things to come?
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I am right. I thought it was Mika. I thought it can't be Mika, but it must have been Mika then.
It was Mika.
It was Häkkinen. Didn't he take him out or something? He did something.
So, it was a slightly unusual format for the race. This was the second heat. And because Häkkinen had won the first one, Häkkinen actually only had to follow Schumacher over the line within 3 seconds to win the Macau GP.
Michael actually had to make sure that Häkkinen didn't finish at all.
Yes. So the two of them are way out in front. They're coming down a long straight. And the footage is on YouTube. You'll find it easily. They're coming down the long straight. And it's interesting. Häkkinen knows he only has to follow him over the line, but he clearly wants to get through. And so they're coming down a long straight. Häkkinen goes to make the move. Schumacher swerves right, you know, subtly, not really aggressively, but it causes, and perhaps it's a black and white thing, okay? It's not a black and white thing. There are shades of grey, so you can't necessarily apportion blame to one of the drivers. But what happens is Häkkinen goes to make the move, drives into the back of Schumacher's car for whatever reason, loses his, he crashes into the wall out of the race. Schumacher loses his rear wing, but is able to continue and goes on to win the Macau GP. But the point is,
without a rear wing.
But in very controversial circumstances. I mean, it really was a sign of things to come. Here is a ruthless competitor who will do what it takes to beat the opposition. And
so, I mean, I have seen it. No, if I have seen that, it was years and years and years ago. So if you're looking at it, was this kind of like a sort of Max Lewis cops 50-50, you could argue it both ways, or did Michael just take him out?
You can argue it both ways. And there is a quote from Häkkinen basically blaming himself because
he certainly doesn't, I should never have tried to overtake him.
Yeah, and he certainly doesn't blame Schumacher entirely. So it's one of those where you can debate it
very
forever.
Interesting.
So just fascinating that even back then there was this little sign of, you know, something about this guy, Michael Schumacher. But anyway, all this stuff that he did in 90 and 91, it ultimately landed him a shot in a Formula One car with Jordan at Spa. Do you remember the story?
Bertrand Gachot.
And do you know what? He is the guest on this week's or last week's F1 Beyond the Grid podcast. And he explains in detail the incident that got him locked up.
So he maced a London taxi driver, didn't he?
It was, yeah, tear gas. Because apparently in Paris, it's not a weapon. In France, it wasn't a weapon. But here it counts as a weapon. And so, a dangerous weapon. So he got banged up for it. He did several months in the nick.
But he still let off of presumably a canister of tear gas in a London taxi or a London taxi driver.
Yeah, he did.
It's probably not for this podcast, but as a result of that, he was at Her Majesty's pleasure when he should have been at Spa.
Rather indisposed, yeah.
Yes.
It's true. And so Eddie Jordan found this this promising young racing driver. I mean, some people say that he was an unknown. He clearly wasn't. If he was a German F3 champion, race-winning world sports car driver,
you would think with those credentials, the likelihood is that you would do some Formula One at some stage.
Yeah.
But I think he got the drive because Willy Weber told Eddie that Michael, you know, loved Spa and was great round Spa and, you know, he'd be perfect. He'd never been there. And his teammate, who was De Cesaris, was going to sort of show him round, but for some reason didn't. And so I think Michael learnt Spa on a Brompton fold-up bicycle.
That's an effort getting up Eau Rouge, isn't it?
I think, well, yeah, but Michael was always the fittest bloke in Formula One, wasn't he?
True.
I think that's what happened. And he qualified. He out-qualified De Cesaris, didn't he? Who'd been around in Formula One for, like, forever. Mm. And Michael turns up, having never been to this track before. It's amazing, isn't it, given how close. If you think he grew up in Kirpen, which isn't far from the Nürburgring, sort of Cologne way. So it's only an hour and a half from Spa. Has he really never been? In all the racing that he did, never. But anyway, that is as I've been told, at least. And qualifying, he goes and blows his teammate into the weeds, and then I think the clutch goes on the line, and so that's the end of that, isn't it?
In the Beyond the Grid podcast, there's a line from Gachot. He says, "I think he received a letter from De Cesaris saying, 'Don't worry about the German. He beat me in qualifying here, but I'll get him next time,' or something." I'm not sure you would, mate.
There wasn't a next time, was there?
There wasn't that was a next the one time, then. No. So,
I mean, technically,
before he blew it up on the line,
you know, technically, he didn't actually race for Jordan, did he? I'm not sure. He went a few yards or something.
Yeah, there you go. So he retired very early on, didn't he? But do you remember watching qualifying that year? Do you remember thinking? You don't? Okay.
No, I don't. I'm sorry. No, I don't. I wish I'd been that prescient. I'm not even sure I remembered watching it. I'm just trying to think when I did log on to Michael. Don't know. He just kind of. I think it was when he started to, you know, consistently put in results because he had a really good result in his next race. I'm trying to remember where it was.
So he'd been nicked by Benetton.
Was it Monza?
It was the Italian GP. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's right. So he got nicked by Flav. Eddie got very hot under the collar, tried to sue Flav, lost. So Michael went, but he lost because the agreement was all there, but somebody hadn't signed it, so it wasn't binding. So Michael goes to Benetton, and in his second race, he comes fifth, doesn't he? And yeah, I mean, amazing.
And he, well, his teammate as well.
Oh, bleh, Nelson Piquet.
Mm.
Yes?
So triple world champion,
Nelson Piquet.
Yeah, and Schumacher beats him in his second race.
He out-qualified him as well.
Yeah.
Out-qualified him and out-raced him, because I think Piquet came behind him, sixth or something or whatever, yeah, but definitely out-qualified and out-raced a triple world champion in the same car in his second race. That should have told you something, shouldn't it?
He's arrived, isn't he? He's arrived.
Piquet would have been past his best by then. I mean, Piquet was... This was 91. This was like 10 years after his first title. But even so, you know, he was not some tugger. He was, triple champion. Yeah, good effort.
So Schumacher with Benetton became a race winner at Spa in 1992. Didn't take long, did it? And then he
loved Spa, though. He always said it was his favourite circuit.
You can see why. I mean, what a special place that is even now. And, of course, Schumacher, as we know, he won his first title in 1994. Do you want to briefly explain the circumstances?
Well, I mean, he had, obviously, 1994 was the year that the sport lost, well, not just Ayrton, but Roland Ratzenberger at Imola in May. And Michael, by this stage, was in the Benetton with the Ford V8 in the back, which wasn't the most powerful engine out there, but the car handled extremely well. And obviously, that was the year of the driver aids scandal. I don't think it's too strong a word to use. And I think what people forget is that Benetton were by no means the only team who were A, investigated for having dodgy software, and B, found to have had dodgy software. Can't remember the other teams, but there were plenty of them. I think the reason that Benetton got particularly hauled over the coals for it was because I think they had, in addition to everything else, they had traction control system on their car. And for people like me, who were such, you know, who idolised Ayrton, the idea that he died trying to keep up with somebody driving a bent car was really quite hard to take. Now, everybody got away with it. Certainly Benetton got away with it, because although nobody disputes that all this stuff... Do you remember there was a screen, I think it was on the steering wheel, which had various options, all of which were fine. Option 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And those were all the options. Unless you pressed the down button a few more times, and there was no option 11, and there was no option 12, and then suddenly, off the bottom of your screen, there was option 13. And that was this, I seem to remember, traction control thing. And the only reason they got away with it, no one denied it was on the car, but they couldn't demonstrate that it had been used. And the rule said, did not say it was illegal to have it, the rule said it was illegal to use it. And again, it was just another one of those, how many times in the history of motor racing has really bad stuff been allowed to happen because some idiot didn't draft the rules, but didn't actually think. You know, if you're going to sit there drafting rules, you must know that the moment these things are published, A, they're set in stone, and B, that every engineer and every team on every grid that's going to race is going to be all over them like a rash. And these are some of the most intelligent people, you know, in the world, who are employed because they got brains the size of Bournemouth. And they're just going to look at it from every angle and keep looking and keep looking until they find a way around it. So you think you would... I mean, to me, that's a really basic thing. You know, it's absolutely fine. Help yourself. You have as much of this stuff on your cars, you're like, just don't use it. I mean, anyway.
And these teams, they even get lawyers to look through these regulations with a lawyer's eye, look for the loopholes. And they will find them. If they're there, they will find them.
And anyway, it all comes down to Australia, doesn't it? The last race of the year, which back then would have been Adelaide, I guess. You know, Damon was coming. And so and Michael realised... And Michael was leading, that's right. Michael was leading the race, and he binned it. And he knew his race was over. And he knew, therefore, that his championship was over because Damon was just about to overtake him. And then that would be it. So he literally, as you know, in the latter part of his crash, he just thought, well, I'll take him with me. And he did. And he just drove into Damon.
Quite intentionally.
I have to say, quite intentionally. And I think of all the stuff that he did in his career, I think that was probably his lowest moment. I mean, there have been others, which maybe we'll get to. But, I mean, certainly for me at the time, I just thought that was particularly given, obviously, you know, we're all Damon fans because he was British, nevertheless, but also, you know, I think actually it was because he was Ayrton's teammate. And, you know, it would have been, you know, in the same way that, I don't know, that, you know, Graham Hill picked Lotus up off the ground in 1968 when Jim Clark got killed and won the championship that year. It would have been so good if Damon had been able to do, you know, Graham's son, Damon, had been able to do the same thing for Williams in 94. But because of Michael's choice in the last race of the year to take out Damon and win his first world championship in that manner, that never happened. And if you'd said to me at that moment, one day you'll become a real Michael Schumacher fan, I would have either thumped you or just, you know, laughed you out of the room. There you go.
It's quite a journey, isn't it? I suspect, I was too young, I don't remember this, but I suspect if you were an Ayrton fan or a Damon fan or a Williams fan, it would have been an inexcusable, unforgivable act. And probably decades later, you'd be justified in still not liking Michael Schumacher, wouldn't you, because of that one thing.
I bet he regrets it. I bet you. I may be wrong about this. Maybe someone can tell us. But I think did he not at some stage say that he, if he'd had his time again, he'd have done things differently in that race? Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure about that. But yeah, I'm sure he regrets it. He must do. He couldn't not, particularly given all you know, everything else that he went on to achieve. But you know, he didn't know that at the time. I mean, at the time, he was the young hotshot. He'd never won a world championship. And he knew that's what he had to do. I mean, the thing, what I would say about that is, however terrible it was, and it was awful, and it was inexcusable, and maybe not unforgivable, but not far off, I do at the same time, I do understand it. I do understand, you know, as much as I could, having never been in a remotely similar situation myself, just thinking, this is all I have ever worked for. This is all I've ever fought for. This is the culmination of my career, and I'm about to see it just go up in smoke. I can't let that happen. And then in that moment of madness, you just do something, you just do what you have to do, and you don't think hard enough about, yeah, I'm not in any way excusing it, but yeah, I do understand the thought process.
This is why Michael Schumacher is a good subject for this episode, so this podcast, because he's not just a golden boy. It's not all sunshine and rainbows, is it? There is an edge to his character. I mean, it says something that a person could take any satisfaction whatsoever from winning a championship that way. I think I'd be desperately trying to, if I had that moment of madness and won the championship because of it, I'd be desperately trying to get myself disqualified from the race, whatever it took. I just can't imagine that at the end of the day, when you've celebrated and partied and you put your head back on your pillow, surely there'll be something going, didn't do it in the right way, though.
And maybe there was. I mean, I think there probably would be. I mean, I can remember a particularly difficult moment when, I think it was in the press conference after the race, he dedicated his championship to Senna. And I suspect he did that for the right reasons. But having been the bloke who nicked that championship from Senna's teammate, I thought that was inelegant. And I just thought that, you know, there might have been a time and a place for that, but it wasn't just... Anyway, but...
Okay, well, let's move on to some of the rosier aspects of Michael Schumacher and his career. So he won the championship again the next year. So he's a two-time world champion. Gets snapped
up by...
That was
a much easier championship because he had a Renault engine in the back. So he suddenly had, you know, he had the best chassis and he had the best engine, and he was Michael Schumacher, so that's not a bad combination, is it? So no great surprises that he won it that year. I mean, I think he walked it, didn't he?
Yeah. And that was enough to get him snapped up by Ferrari. As you say, Ferrari was a basket case when he went there. But it was clearly a long-term project, wasn't it? Because that was when Todd Braun, was it Rory Byrne as well?
Todd Braun,
And Schumacher all came together. And they they started building the team around Michael. Ultimately, the tyres, it was Bridgestone, wasn't it, who they worked with? It took a few years, but they came to dominate the sport. But even so, there were signs very early on, weren't there? And I think you've said in the past that Michael Schumacher's best ever race came at the Spanish Grand Prix in 1996.
Yeah. So you have to remember. So the Ferrari F310 was a really, it was a really, really bad car. It didn't have much downforce, and the downforce that it did have was a bit all over the place. It was aerodynamically not very stable at all. And, you know, it wasn't within a million miles of the Williamses. You know, Michael was so unsure of the car in practice that he tried two completely diametrically opposed setups, and neither of them was working. He somehow, through some totally insane lap, managed to qualify at third on the grid. I mean, Eddie Irvine was back in sixth or seventh. But then come race day, it rained. And it's worth going onto YouTube, it really is, because all of it's there, but a lot of it's there. But I can remember watching this thing live and just thinking, you know, there were times when he was, you know, in this difficult car, 3-4 seconds of that quicker than anybody else on the circuit. And you don't need me to tell you who else was out there that day. And there were cars pinging off left, right and center. And he just made them look idiotic. You know, you could actually, it's one of those very rare occasions, is you could actually see with your eyes, you didn't have to look at a timing screen or anything, that there was one car driving around that track at a completely different speed to all the others. And he wasn't doing it through being, you know, Prostlite and Captain Precision and balance. He was driving it like a Mark II Escort at times. I mean, it was just like he was having the best time in the world. It was so free-spirited and so wonderful. And the absolutely staggering thing is that he finished the race, I think, like 3/4 of a minute ahead of anybody else. He lapped the entire field up to third place. And yet he did it for at least half the race with a really, really sick engine. To the extent that for the last, whatever it was, 20, 30 laps, he backed off completely because he thought this thing's not going to get there if I continue to wring its neck. So if the car had stayed healthy, I mean, he'd have finished days ahead of anybody else in a rubbish car in the most impossible conditions. He just made everybody else out there just look like they were in a different race. It was amazing. It was actually, I might see if I can dig it out. There was a quote from some. There was, hang on. Okay, so somebody said afterwards, "That was not a race, that was a demonstration of brilliance. The man is in a class of his own. There is no one in the world anywhere near him. I do not think there has ever been a driver who is so far clear of the field in terms of his ability. It was one of the most fantastic demonstrations of skill I have ever seen, up there with Senna and Fangio." And that wasn't his manager saying that, or his PR person. That was Stirling Moss.
That's okay? Special.
So that gives you an idea of what went on in Spain that day.
That is extraordinary. With a pig of a car as well. I will skip forward a little bit. And we know that he won his third title in 2000 and then every one until 2004. Just utterly dominant at times. Peerless. Class of the field. So he set all these incredible records. What was he known for? I mean, he set new standards for health and nutrition and fitness for Grand Prix drivers. He was known for being a rain master. He was known for his pace over one lap, but also his pace over a stint, qualifying laps for 20 laps at a time. So really, he's one of these. Do you know what? I often think that all this talk about the GOAT, the greatest of all time, we can never know. I think all we can do is actually recognise the handful of drivers who truly raised the bar, who really set new standards for people who do what they do. And there is no question that in many ways Schumacher was one of those guys. He belongs to that elite.
He did. And also, I think the other thing, I think, so I was going to, his another great contribution, which we are enjoying to this day. I don't think Sebastian Vettel would be in Formula One without Michael Schumacher. Formula One was, you know, before Michael, there had been so few German racing drivers. Wolfgang von Trips was clearly very good, but he was around in the late 50s and early 60s. Jochen Mass. But, you know, it was a kind of like a niche sport in Germany. And then Michael came along, and he was an absolute bloody superstar. And obviously, and then Ralph came along too. And Ralph wasn't slow either. And I think that he established in his country, he put Formula One on the map. I think Seb has said that he was certainly inspired by Michael. And yeah, I mean, who knows? So I think, you know, people probably don't think about that too much. But worth considering.
It's a good point. Let's just rattle through some of the other controversies. And of course, there were plenty. But Jerez 97 was fairly heinous. Again, that's on YouTube. You can see.
Yeah.
Jacques Villeneuve overtakes him, and Michael, there's no two ways about it. He drives into Villeneuve, trying, it would seem, to end his race so that he won the championship. In commentary says, "You hit him in the wrong place, mate, or son, or something," doesn't he? It's really interesting.
I need to go and look at it. I did. Patrick Head once showed me around the Williams collection, all their cars that they've got stacked up on racks from all the years, and Jacques' car is there, and it's still got Michael's tyre mark down the side pod on it.
Wow.
From where it absolutely hit him in the wrong place.
That's a bit of history, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then there was Monaco 2006 with Ferrari, when he's not the dominant force anymore. And Alonso won the previous year with Renault, and he's, I think, leading the championship again at this point, Alonso. And so Michael, in qualifying, he stops at Rascas. The net result.
The point being is that Michael was on provisional pole, but Fernando was out there going faster. And if Michael didn't do something promptly, Alonso was going to get pole. So he just thought, well, I'll just park the car here. I mean, it's just
the other one.
And the thing is, and what I struggle with, I guess, is, you know, this is not just some young hotshot anymore.
Seven-time world champion at that point.
It's a seven-time world champion behaving like that. And I just, you know, he must have just thought, actually, I'm better than that. I just shouldn't have done it.
You'd hope so.
And also, you know, I think they tried to defend it and say, oh, no, we had a technical problem, this, that and the other. And it was just so blatant, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I just wonder if he's got a temper and the red mist comes down and he responds in an almost childlike way. And then surely immediately after, he just thinks, oh, no, I just can't believe that he justifies it to himself in any way.
Yeah, it's something like that because, yeah, I mean, you know, well, he was, as we know, away from the track, a completely different person.
Let's come on to that in just a sec, because the only other one that I think we should mention is the 2010 Hungarian Grand Prix. Michael Schumacher is back after a few years out. He's with Mercedes. And Rubens Barrichello, teammates for a long time, is attempting to pass Schumacher down the inside on the main straight. And Schumacher closes the line really suddenly, really aggressively, and almost puts Barrichello into the wall at the best part of 200 miles an hour. It was a genuinely dangerous move, and nothing, thank God, came of it. But,
I mean, I know that Rubens was really, really unhappy about it. Nothing happened. I mean, okay, Michael did say, I gave him space.
Yeah, technically he did.
You know, and in another world, I mean, how different is that to, I don't know, Lewis and Max and the conversations we had about, you know, who should have given who space there? I mean, I guess it was the context, wasn't it? It was because they were going so fast and he was absolutely up against, you know, a solid barrier, I guess, and the sort of thoughts of what could have gone wrong if he'd hit that. But, yeah, I mean, I know exactly the event that you're talking about, and, you know, I think you're right. I think it was far too aggressive. But Michael Wood always said there was space. You know, this was hard driving. What do you expect from me? I'm Michael Schumacher. Of course, you know, I'm going to leave you as little room as humanly possible. But I will leave you room. And if you're good enough, you'll get through it.
Ruthless competitor. So this was during his comeback with Mercedes. He did 3 years, didn't he? With a largely uncompetitive Merc. Although he did put it on pole at Monaco in 2012. The gutting thing is, he had a penalty from the previous race, I think. So he didn't get to start from pole. Which is a shame, because he starting from pole in Monaco, no matter, even if you've got a midfield car, you've got a bloody good chance of winning the thing, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah, and what really saddens me about that time in his life is that I remember Sterling came back and said, oh, I think he's a bit past it now, because he wasn't doing very well. And three seasons away, how do you come back from that? And so on and so on. And I think at the time, I think we all probably thought, oh, well, you know, the old boy's, you know, not quite got his edge anymore. And what we didn't know at the time was that he was regularly, and I need to go and look at them, but I think he outdrove his teammate for the majority of those seasons. And that teammate was that Formula One world champion, the person who would go on to become a Formula One world championship known as Nico Rosberg.
I thought Nico had got the better of him.
Oh, you might be right.
I think he did. Maybe it was closer. Maybe Michael was closer than some of us suspected, but I think overall Nico beat him.
Okay, then I take all that back. But okay, maybe. But even so, you know, I think that what I would say is, regardless of that, is that Michael wasn't as bad then as I don't think people realised just how uncompetitive that Mercedes was at the time. And I think particularly now that Mercedes basically wins everything, it's hard to imagine a time when they were real, you know, the real sort of, you know, also-rans, middle order runners. But they absolutely were at the time.
Can you, just while I'm searching something, can you fill for a moment and discuss, there was a lovely quote from somebody in the article that you wrote for the Intercooler app, describing people who actually knew Michael. Okay, there were lots of people who didn't like the racing driver, but people who actually knew him.
Well, okay, so this, the bloke you're talking about is a chap called Robin Grant, who used to run the fabrication shop at Benetton, and knew Michael extremely well. And when I first got to know Robin and found out what he did for a living and so on and so forth, I said to him, you know, what is Michael like? And I can't remember the exact quote, but it was along the lines of, you will find loads of people who don't like Michael. They will be rivals who are much slower than him, teammates who just can't keep up with him, that sort of thing. Yeah. And then he paused and said, but what you will never find is somebody who knows Michael the person rather than Michael the driver, who dislikes him. They all absolutely adored the bloke. I mean, professionally speaking, he was the hardest working bloke in Formula One. You know, he would turn up first, he would leave last. The mechanics all adored him because, you know, he was never aloof with them. He worked so hard, and, you know, that's how he managed to build. I mean, he built teams around him because he was such an amazing driver, but also because he was part of the team. It wasn't like the team was working for this superstar who was kind of up there and, you know, sometimes deign to say hello. He was absolutely part of the team, and they all idolized him because he was this incredible driver who was making their work so worthwhile. And then, so after Robin had said that to me, and just sort of idly, every time I ever met anyone who knew Michael, I would just, you know, ask them the question. And today, it has always stood up. I've never met anyone who knew Michael as a person rather than Michael as a driver, who didn't like him. I think it probably does. But, you know, they're just so different. I mean, I'm not going to bang on about it, but that time I met Senna and spent a day with him, the moment the pressure was off, the moment he was away from the media, the moment there weren't people sticking microphones, the moment it was just the two of us alone in the car, he just became a different person. And he just became this really funny, chatty, interesting, interested bloke. I never met Michael. I haven't met Michael. So I don't know if he's the same, but I suspect he probably is. And that is certainly what those who, you know, the people I've spoken to who do know him say about him. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
Just so we've got it right on the record, Rosberg did beat him all three seasons, but in 2011 it was very close, just a few points between them. But there we go, that's Michael Schumacher. What a fascinating character. Enormous achievements, controversial throughout his career, but... yeah, a really good topic for this podcast, I think. And as ever, of course, we wish him and his family all the best. And we're,
absolutely.
We're very much looking forward to this documentary, aren't we? Hoping it's a true reflection of just a fascinating person.
And also, one last thing. He still, well, according to Wikipedia, that well-known authority, which I just looked at on my other computer just now while you were saying that, he still, with Sebastian, ties for the greatest number of races ever won in a season, which is 13. And I think he's still got the greatest number of fastest laps that anybody's ever had. So Lewis hasn't got them all yet.
Work to do, Lewis. Work to
He'll get them, no doubt. But, you know, he hasn't been entirely eclipsed by Lewis yet.
Okay. Good. All right. Well, let's leave that one there. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I enjoyed that. Thought that was good. We'll do some more of these. Yep. And yeah, give us some suggestions, some people you'd like us to talk about. They don't have to be world champions either.
No, they don't have to be racing drivers. They don't have to be drivers.
No, they don't.
It doesn't have to come from, you know, the race industry. It can come from the road car side. Well, whatever. Just, you know, but they've got to be interesting.
They've got to be interesting.
And not just interesting for their work, but interesting for their personalities too.
Quite right. Okay, well, please, everybody, remember to rate and review the podcast. That really does help. And also remember to go and download the Intercooler app. Start your free trial. You get a month to decide if you like it or not. We think you will. There's some great stuff up there. So go and download the app. And as ever, we'll be back to talk to you all again next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks all.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.